Hello, Narnie Webbers. This is Glumpuddle.
And I'm Rillian. Hello.
And we're reading C.S. Lewis's The Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
"Looks as if this might be all that's left of one of our seven lords," said Edmund. "Just what I was thinking," said Caspian. "I wonder which it was. There's nothing on the dagger to show, and I wonder how he died. And how we are to avenge him," added Rippercheep.
Last time on Voyage of the Dawn Treader, we left our heroes. Really, it's like we're not that far into the book, and we've already had one of those, maybe the most powerful character moment in the story. So,
it's true.
Where do we go from here?
But again, it kind of goes back to, you know, what I love about Dawn Treader is it's not like, you know, build up, convert, and then that's the end of the story. You know, I mean, one of the things I love about Narnia in every single story is kind of like a story after the story.
Yeah.
No matter how the story ends, you know, oh, there's so much more that comes after this.
Dawn Treader, just as much as, or if not more so than I think any other Narnia books, yeah, you absolutely get the sense that they're sailing through and catching glimpses of other stories in their peripheral vision. And actually, that leads us into our next island here, which is Burnt Island, which we don't see.
Which, it's almost easy to forget that it exists.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do.
Like, you almost have to backtrack. Like, you think towards, you're thinking about the last part of the story, you think, oh, well, how did Reap get that little, oh, yeah, there was an island, you know?
I think that was always a bit for a long time. As I was rereading the series, I would come to this part and go, oh, yeah, that's where he got the coracles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I totally agree. We're really at a boring stretch of the voyage, not in terms of narrative, but I just mean it starts raining for a while, mm-hmm. and Eustace and Rippercheep are playing chess, and Lewis actually mentions that Eustace started to be more like his old self for a bit. He told us, you know, towards the end of the last chapter that most of these moments he wasn't going to notice.
Yeah.
But there's still an acknowledgement that this is still a process. Eustace wasn't just magically changed and that was it. There's still a bit of a process going on.
Yeah. And you know, again, you have to, that's one thing that a book can kind of do is a book can throw in the mundane,
yeah.
just mentioning it, and it doesn't really bog down the story. Like a story author could mm-hmm. just write, several boring weeks went by. You know?
Yeah, yeah, but, you know, and that's basically what Lewis does here. He just spends a few paragraphs on Burnt Island and a couple on, and it was raining and they were sort of cooped up and there wasn't really much happening.
And it just kind of says, you know, hey, this is a real voyage and, you know, not every moment's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, real life, there's ups and downs and there's boredom and they, you know, hey, they were bored for a little while. And then,
but
you know,
it's important here that there's a sort of a boring stretch of the voyage because that sort of sets up the sea serpent, I think. That it's just we're on the water and there's no sign of land anywhere. It's got to be really tedious, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes the sea serpent.
The timing of the sea serpent in the story. Does
uh-huh.
it seem? Why do you think Lewis kind of threw? It feels to me like he just kind of threw it into the middle. I'm not saying he didn't have a plan, but it. You would almost expect something like this to be later on in the story.
Well, why is it here? I mean, technically, you probably could have it between just about any two islands, and it wouldn't affect the narrative hardly at all. I think it's the main thing that comes out of this is it's an opportunity for Eustace to show how he's changed. Lewis has sort of told us he's changed. But now, as the sea serpent's wrapping itself around the ship, Lewis writes, "Eustace, who had been trying very hard to behave well till the rain and the chest put him back, now did the first brave thing he had ever done." And then he takes Caspian's second-best sword. And they all praise Eustace's valor later, even though it didn't do any good. So I think that's one of the main things it does, is really say, hey, look, Eustace, he's changing.
Uh-huh.
That would be my guess as why it's here. I think Lewis wanted to follow up the undragoning of Eustace with giving him the opportunity to actually demonstrate through action how he's changed.
Right.
I think it's establishing that, okay, adventures can happen even on the ocean. It's not just, the ocean isn't just a commercial break from the islands. That even when they're on the even when they're on the water, there's still danger. And so I think that's significant. And then there's those two character moments. There's the Eustace one, and then there's another interesting out of character moment with Rippercheep, I think,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of a favorite for a lot of people. Everyone, it's, you know, shooting arrows, or, you know, Eustace tries his bit with the sword. You know, they're trying everything, and all of a sudden they hear Rippercheep shout, "Don't fight! Push!" And Lewis writes, "It was so unusual for the mouse to advise anyone not to fight. that even in that terrible moment, every eye turned to him.
It comes out. So I mean, looking back, you realize that it is consistent with his character, but it's not expected. It's not something you would predict. You know, because when you think about it, okay, he's someone who never loses his cool. He never once gets flustered and loses any kind of mental command of the situation. And so it makes perfect sense.
It's also establishing just how unusual this is. So I think the moment at the end of the book where he throws his sword away, I think is that much stronger because Lewis has emphasized that much more here.
Yeah.
How weird it is for him to suggest not to fight.
Yeah.
But they're on to the next island. And one of the things I really love about rereading Don Treader is sometimes I forget about the order of the islands. And so I'll be rereading it and I'll just have that brief moment where I'm going, wait a minute, what's next? And I actually don't know what's coming next. Uh-huh. So I was like, that happens fairly often when I get to this part of the book. There's a very important moment. We don't know it's an important moment, but where they're trying to decide which stream they're going to go to. And Drinian starts going one way. They say, no, we'll be drier if we go. There's some cover over there. Let's go that way. And it turns out to be a very good thing that they did that. And then for a while, the story turns into a bit of a detective story where they're looking for clues, which I guess in a way, the whole thing is a detective story, trying to find out what happened to the lords. And they're kind of on their trail, I guess. But there's even a bit here where Lewis says that, you know, Edmund, who had read, you know, a lot of detective stories, I guess he's read the right kind of books, unlike Eustace.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting mystery. Why is all the armor and everything here, but the body's gone?
I actually remember for some reason, this island, I think, stuck with me. Some things stuck with me more as a kid, reading the books than other islands. I think, the sea serpent stuck with me. I think this actually stuck with me in some ways more than finding the last three lords.
This is probably my favorite island, I think, just because the water that turns stuff into gold. There is something about that.
I remember feeling kind of a little bit creeped out as Edmund is saying, why are there no bones? You know,
yeah.
And if it was an enemy, why would we have the armor left? You know, if it were an animal, right. Where would be the bones? You know, and I think as I was listening to that, I thought that's actually really creepy. What would do that? Because you're trying to think too, and I remember thinking, oh, this is probably in some ways, this is one where I just thought this is not going to end well. You know,
right.
You could even think to yourself about, you know, Dragon Island. Oh, that's kind of sad. But this one, you just think, this one is really, really not going to end well. Whatever it is, it's just not good.
Right.
I remember, actually, the one thing I do remember is when I learned the water turned him into gold. I remember thinking, like, having this terrifying feeling of actually, like, myself. What would it feel like if, you know, my lungs and my throat and everything turned into gold? And I just, you know? I remember thinking,
wondered the same thing about getting turned into stone in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. What would that actually feel like?
Yeah. So I think that part of it I thought was actually scary, which Lewis kind of alludes to. You know, Lucy's obviously thinking of the same thing, where, you know, he dived in, don't say it, you know?
Uh-huh. But yeah, I think just in general, this, what's, you know, initially called gold water, and if it ends up being called death water, and because initially it starts out kind of interesting and kind of cool. Oh my gosh, so that, you know, water that turns things into gold, and they're discovering and experimenting with it, and then slowly it becomes more and more horrible as they realize what happened. I know this is a big deal, water that turns things into gold. I think that anybody could fall victim to greed in that situation, but. Do you think there's actually something magical about the island that's having some effect on them? Or...
See, that's what I've wondered.
I really don't know, because I definitely think something magical happened at some point.
Well, obviously, because they it says their memories are kind of...
Yeah.
I think that was Aslan.
Aslan, but that's another thing. What exactly happened there? Because they're arguing about it, and... Then about, you know, Caspian once says it's his island and he's bounding everyone to secrecy. And Edmund is all, yo, what? Who are you to give me an order?
Yeah.
And even Lucy's starting to lose it just a little bit.
You know what? What I'm kind of wondering here. I don't want to leave this point because it's a question I think it's important to think about. Do you ever wonder what Ruby Cheap is thinking as all this is going on? Because he's kind of silent during this argument.
That's true. He is. He doesn't really say anything.
I mean, he does. I don't think he says. I mean, the only thing that he would basically, where he would actually say anything, I think, where it's implied, was where Aslan appears and they all react. But he doesn't really get involved when, right from the time they discover what that it turns things into gold.
Uh huh. Well, I mean, like, what are Reepicu's primary concerns? You know, he wants honor and adventure. He wants to try to avenge. Wants to try to avenge the Seven Lords if he can.
Uh huh.
And like. Okay, a water that turns things into gold. I think, what does that have to do with Reepicu? But he probably is just staying there.
He's like, what is going? You know, eating popcorn,
whatever. Yeah. Okay, I guess he found one of our lords. I guess, you know, we can move on now. We found out what happened. I guess we can move on now.
Yeah,
okay, well, I'll just wait for you guys to finish.
Yeah, no, I think that with Reepicu, I mean, I think that's probably a good way of saying it. In some ways, I do think that it's. I think it's okay. I'm gonna cheat. Say it's both. I think on one hand, I think it's the point of the story is emphasizing, you know, there might be a curse here. But
because like, they're arguing,
think...
and then Aslan shows up, and they see him, and they're sort of, oh my gosh, and they say he looked, you know, much bigger than they'd ever seen him before.
And I think that's
and
partly
then,
what Aslan is doing to them.
So is Aslan actually because he gets back and basically, I want to read this exactly since this is such a weird part of it. So, and then all Aslan's there, and then all of a sudden he's gone, and Lewis writes, and nobody ever saw how or where he went. They mm-hmm. looked at one another like people waking from sleep. What were we talking about? Said Caspian. Have I been making rather an ass of myself? And then that's when Reepicu decides on the name Deathwater, and mm-hmm. Caspian thinks that's a good name, though he's not sure why. Then when they get back to the Dawn Treader, Drinian says their majesties all seemed a bit bewitched when they came aboard. So did Aslan actually wave his magic wand and erase their memories, or was it just the sight of seeing him was so unexpected and amazing and put things in perspective for them? Or I mean, did it literally erase their minds?
I think it's a little bit of the latter. I think first of all, going back to is the gold water having an effect on them? I think part of it you do have to think about. You know, what if? Like, I mean, think about what people. What would people do if that, I'm not going to say technology, but if they found that, you know, somewhere, what would people go to, you know, not going to say,
like
not
a lot
say
of people would have
killed,
Uncle Andrew's mindset in Magician's Nephew when he gets there and immediately wants to,
I mean,
use
it's
to build
kind of like how many friends would become enemies over something like that? You know, if one wanted soul and they both discovered it together, I think that he's kind of bringing in the, hey, this would actually be completely amazing to have, you know.
Right.
But it would.
I guess if we look at the rest of Narnia, I think generally we do see that the problems are internal. Like in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, yes, there was Turkish delight, but you get really get Lewis seems to go
it's
out
like
of his
it
way to emphasize.
It.
Yeah, it's but like, Lewis seems to go out of his way to emphasize, but it was Edmund's choice ultimately.
Right.
It did. He spent
it's
so
like
much time on
any
that.
Kind of the any time these curses or things are impacting people, it's you know whether it's the White Witch in the Magician's Nephew, it's like they're just magnifying what's already there. They find people's weaknesses and they prey on what's already there.
Right.
And I do
so
think that
I'm just saying that looking at the rest of the series, that kind of affects my interpretation of this. As I say, it probably. Maybe it was the island, but if it was, it was just tickling something that was already inside them, I guess. And Aslan, and I don't know if Aslan actually did anything. I really think it was just seeing Aslan put things in perspective for them, and it was so unexpected to see him that I don't think their minds were literally erased.
Well, and why is Reep silent? You know, I think you kind of answered it because. It's easy to see, like, if you were to just think, okay, of Lucy, Edmund, Reep, and Caspian, who would have the weakness towards gold? You think, well, the least likely to have that kind of weakness would be Reep and Lucy. You know, you just,
yeah, definitely.
But I think that part of what Lewis is doing here is, even with all of that, seeing Aslan is so amazing, like, just that by itself, you know? I mean, it'd be kind of like if, you know, two people were arguing over a move in checkers, you know, and then all of a sudden a tornado appears, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's not even, it doesn't even necessarily have to be magical. It's just that awe-inspiring.
Probably won't remember much about the game of checkers.
Wait, what were we? You know?
Yeah, I tend to lean that direction.
It's just the nature of who he is. It does that to people.
Yeah. All right. So next. All right. And this story lends itself to that. Okay. There's that complete. Now on to the next conversation. But so they've now found three lords, and what they found Burn on the Lone Islands. They found Octesian, as they suppose, on Dragon Island, and now they found the Lord Restamar in Deathwater, though they don't yet know it's Lord Restamar. Mm-hmm. They'll narrow that down
process
later.
Of elimination.
Yeah, now on to the next island, and initially the most interesting thing about this island, kind of the creepiest thing about it, is that it's so normal.
Yeah,
like they get there and the grass looks like it's been mowed and there's no branches or leaves on the ground. Mm-hmm. And Eustace even says, "Oh, maybe we've come to a civilized country at last." And it gets even more complicated when, in a maybe a slightly contrived move, Lucy has a stone in her shoe and so stays behind to get it out, and she mm-hmm. overhears the voices. Maybe slightly contrived on Lewis's part to make that happen, and she doesn't hear a footstep. She just hears, you know, pounding, and we don't know what they are. And I was trying to like piece this together, like, okay, a obviously a recently inhabited island, and now no one here. Invisible people is not one that crossed my mind. And
yeah,
it's a great unexpected little turn.
What I think is kind of interesting, and I was just thinking about it. On one hand, I think it would be as I've thought about, I haven't really written much fiction at all, but I've just thought about it, and I think, you know, if you were to try to write a section of a book where they're in genuine danger, you know, I mean, they probably, if they were to fight, you know, some of them would have been killed, you know, but it's still funny. I mean, you think, you're listening to the talk of the I'm going to say minions, because now I'm thinking of Despicable Me. You know, you just think, man, these guys are complete idiots. I mean, really, they're just babbling idiots. Oh, you're right, Chief. No one could have missed, forgotten the point better than you. You know, but I'm just thinking, well, but they could kill him. But it's just go to this weird juxtaposition. I enjoy it, little moments like that. Moments where you realize, like, you know, where they throw the spear and it hits the tree, and you realize they could actually kill them, but it's still funny to listen to, you know?
It's fun, because we have this initial fear of them, and we're suspicious of them, of course, because...
But you're just thinking, what on earth is going
on? They're invisible, and what are they? Apparently they're not human, I guess, from the sound of things.
Uh-huh.
And then slowly, as we're listening to them talk, we start going, wait a second, who are these people? And figuring out that they're not...
Uh-huh.
And so... This is probably one of the best examples of us entering a story in the middle. We arrive on this island, and what do these invisible people want? And the chief actually has to sit down and explain this long story that you guys are now a part of. In a lot of ways, we see that throughout the whole voyage. I mean, a burnt island. What was the story there? We'll never really know. And just getting little, and even to an extent, Dragon Island with Octesian. Was he the dragon? How did he become a dragon? And why? What were the others' reactions? And why did they leave him behind? There's clearly lots of stories we're missing out on. But here's one where Lewis is actually going to explain it, which only makes us look at the other ones and go, wow, those are probably just as interesting, even though we'll never hear about it. And so he has to explain the whole story about how they snuck into the magician's. You know, they were uglified, as they call it. They sneak into the magician's room.
And the whole time
you're
wondering, what on earth are these creatures? Like, you know, are they, what are they, you know?
I've always been suspicious of, do you think it's actually true that a little girl has to say the spell?
That's what I've
wondered. Or is that just something they made up? Because that seems very weird. And I love how, the chief actually says, you know, it has to be, you know, don't ask me why, it has to be a little girl that says the spell. And why? Because nothing happens.
Yeah. It makes me wonder, is this just a process of elimination? You know? It's like, well, the little girl, you know, did it, and, you know, that's the only way it works. But I don't know. obviously it worked for Lucy, but then would it have worked for anyone?
But I just wonder, yeah. What if Caspian had done it? Maybe it would have still worked. I don't know. I just wonder where they got that information. Later, Koryakin does say, you know, I knew that you would be along eventually. And I always wonder if he meant, did he mean somebody would be along or a little girl like you would be along? I never quite understood. I mean, the only thing we really, it just seems like to believe it is to take the Chief Duffelpud's word for it. And I'm reluctant to do that. I don't think he's reliable.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe.
I have no idea.
I was, for some reason, this going through it this last time was the first time I ever wondered about that. Because I thought,
oh, really? What? Interesting.
No, seriously. I always took it for granted last times I read it. And I thought, this time I thought, wait a second.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, but for most of this series of podcasts, I've been praising the way Lewis is smart about what he doesn't explain. And this is one area where I do kind of wish he'd been a little more clear, like, wait, why does it have to be a little girl?
Or yeah.
What is that? I don't know, just added a little bit more depth to it. It seems a little bit contrived, like almost like he just wanted Lucy to have to go up there. So we'd like to know a little bit more about that. But awesome book. This is a moment, and there's another moment here that you were talking about earlier, about Reepicheep doing something that it gets kind of out of character, but he explains it. He explains it very well, his reasons for choosing not to fight them.
Her Majesty is in the right, said Reepicheep. If we had any assurance of saving her by battle, our duty would be very plain. It appears to me that we have none. And the service that they ask of her is in no way contrary to Her Majesty's honor, but a noble and heroical act. If the Queen's heart moves her to risk the magician, I will not speak against it. And, oh, yeah, as no one had ever known Reepicheep to be afraid of anything, he could say this without feeling at all awkward. But the boys, who had all been afraid quite often, grew very red. Nonetheless, it was obvious sense that they had to give in.
Yeah. And I think Reepicheep ultimately is all about honor.
Mm-hmm. And I think what I love about it
is he's so fearless, he's ready to pick up his sword and fight at any moment.
But he's also, he admires bravery and courage so much that if he's perfectly willing to let someone else step up and be brave.
Yeah.
He doesn't, he loves it.
I'm sure if he could, he would take Lucy's place, but he can't.
He admires people who are doing the right thing. He isn't brave so he can be brave and show off.
Yeah.
He wants to be brave because he believes it's the right thing to do. And it doesn't have to be him being brave. He just believes that he should be. And
right.
If Lucy is going to be the one to step up when, like he says, it makes the most sense, you know,
right.
We don't have assurance of or even realistic chance of being able to provide a way out of this. But if she can through heroism and bravery, then if she's willing to do it, I'm not going to argue against her.
Reepicheep is not just a total reckless, you know, maniac with a rapier. You know, he has the ability to look at a situation and say, okay, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
So then continue on just a little bit here into the next chapter. They're going to, you know, the invisible people, they invite the guests to dinner, and there was something here that I always took to be an inconsistency that now I'm not so sure is technically, but
okay.
at the end of chapter 9, Reepicheep says, you know, what about your weapons? And then the chief throws a spear and says, oh, they become visible when they leave our hands. So presumably this applies to all objects. But at dinner, we see the plates and bowls and stuff floating around, and you would think they would be invisible until they put them on the table or something like that. However, I've been saying that for a long time, and I always thought that. And then I said it to my brother, and without blinking, he said, oh, they're probably wearing gloves. And you think about it, well, if they were carrying hot soup or something, they probably would be carrying oven mitts or something. And obviously,
or even
their clothes.
If they were like butlers wearing,
their
invisible gloves.
So, like, it's reading into a little bit, but obviously their clothes are invisible because it's touching their skin. Basically, anything that touches their skin becomes invisible, I suppose. I always wonder, what if I went up to them and, like, grabbed their arm? Would I become invisible too?
Find me now!
And that could actually be useful. What if you snuck up on one of them and just grabbed him, and you were invisible too?
And of course,
presumably they can't see each other.
Yeah, that's what I at one point I remember thinking, man, why would they get tired of being invisible? Oh, if they can't see each other, that would be pretty annoying.
That would get really annoying.
Which of course they're bumping into each other, so I guess they can't.
That's true. They can't see each other. That'd be really inconvenient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
All right, but that's where we
I,
are.
I'm going to go with your brother's theory, because once you said, well, if, I thought, oh,
yeah, because he said that, and first I kind of laughed and went, oh, brother, you're thinking too hard, whatever. But then I went, well, wait a minute, it's hot soup and things like that. Maybe they would be wearing oven mitts or something like that. So
I don't know.
It's very possible. Yeah. But Lucy is going to wake up soon, and Lewis writes that it was like waking up the morning of a final exam, and we will examine that at the beginning of the next episode. Ooh, got there. And one of the scarier parts of the series, I think, is where we'll pick up in our next episode.